Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, the Venetia mine shuts down and South Africa's diamond industry is feeling the pressure. Police, permits and bribes as immigration enforcement faces tough questions. A MoneyWeb at Midday investigation. An Israeli oil deal puts South Africa's ICJ credibility to the test. And your rubbish is talking and investors are paying attention. It's Wednesday, the 15th of July. Now, for more than a century, De Beers has been synonymous with South African diamonds, but now the company has announced it's going to suspend production for 2 years at Venetia in Limpopo. It's the country's largest diamond mine. The move comes amid a prolonged slump in diamond prices, weak demand from China, growing competition from lab-grown stones. Also, as parent company Anglo American tries to sell De Beers as part of its broader restructuring. Venetia, by the way, accounts for around 40% of South Africa's diamond production and employs something in the region of 3,500 people. So I think this makes it far more than just a company story. Joining me now is well-known and respected mining commentator and analyst Peter Major. Peter, first of all, welcome. Thank you. Does shutting down this mine for 2 years tell us the diamond industry is facing a structural crisis rather than just a temporary downturn?
It sure does, Jeremy. This is really significant. Venetia is a huge modern mine. They've put over $1 billion in that mine, and it's planned to run at least another 30 years. And it's not only the flagship of diamond mining in South Africa, it's De Beers' flagship. Okay, we can say their big mine in Botswana churns out more, but for South Africa and for the money that they put into this, it's a deep, large underground mine that had 30 years of resources at least. And to just close it like that, it's going to be very large maintenance costs, but they're not going to be anything like the operating costs. And this does indicate we are in very exceptional, hard, difficult times for the industry, for the market, anything related to diamonds.
Peter, if management believes the downturn is temporary, why take such a drastic step instead of simply cutting production?
Well, I think they've cut production a lot. They still lost $550 million last year. They're probably looking at least that this year. And I'm being blunt. I don't know the market that well. But do I see light at the end of the tunnel? No, I don't. I see just enough light for me to keep walking, you know, a tiny little pinprick. Now, yes, they have gone through this before. But remember, De Beers created the world's diamond market. And in a way, they were responsible for a lot of the world's diamond industry, a lot of the world's diamond mines and cutting centers. So they're not doing this lightly. There's no easy answers, which there's just production, always production coming out of unplanned places. And it's not even close to a cartel or a monopoly. So it's pretty much uncontrolled mining. And it's getting to the point it's uncontrolled selling. The big centers now, production centers, include Russia, Canada, Botswana, and now Angola. So there's four countries churning out much more than the original country called South Africa did.
And Peter, add into that mix, as I referenced, weak consumer demand in China and the rise, the increasing rise of lab-grown diamonds. And you have a situation, I would imagine, where the entire economics of the natural diamond industry has changed.
Yeah, you have to ask yourself, why would people buy a natural diamond when the cost of it is 5 to 10 times more than a diamond that is comparable, if not better. A real diamond. Sure, maybe it's lab grown, but it's a real diamond, and they can do almost any carat they want now that'll fit onto your finger. So how do you market it? It was always about marketing. 120 years ago, it was about marketing why people should buy diamonds. You're creating demand like a Gucci or a Louis Vuitton handbag. So you've got to create the marketing image, and then you got to have some kind of control in production and some kind of control in sales. And it's probably further away now than it's ever been since Rhodes took over or started De Beers.
Peter, from a business perspective, as I also referenced, Anglo-American is trying to sell De Beers. One's got to ask if this decision makes the business more attractive to buyers by cutting costs, or does it make it appear like a distressed asset?
In a way, it's both. It's distressed because it's losing money, and it's hard to say why it's going to stop losing money because it's so dependent on something it has no control over, or very little control over. It's so dependent on the price of diamonds going up. So if the price of naturally mined diamonds doesn't go up, I think I'm just guessing, you know, it's half the world's production now uneconomic, you know, and you've got a large head office, you got a large sales chain, marketing train, diamond sorting chain. So is it a distressed asset? Yes, it is. Now, Anglo's says, we all say, this doesn't really fit into a normal mining company, you know, mining a product that has more control over its prices, or at least more predictability. You don't need to market iron ore. You don't need to market platinum, gold, silver, chrome, manganese. But diamonds, they need to be marketed. So you got to have some kind of unison in this industry. Yeah, we're bordering on, you know, monopoly cartel, having all the producers talk to each other, but they have to talk to each other. They have to have some kind of common strategy. Diamonds don't work like those other metals, or you're going to continue seeing what we're doing now. Real prices down 30, 40%. Jeez, we're talking a super cycle of 20 some years in metals where real prices are just continuing to go up, and the diamonds are doing exactly the opposite.
Which suggests, Peter, that if the situation perpetuates and prices remain under pressure for another 2 or 3 years, inevitably we could see further mine closures or even more consolidation across the industry.
I think we're going to see that literally in months ahead, Jeremy. Yeah. 2 more years, you'd see radical, dramatic closures and consolidation. I haven't looked at it enough to know how many producers are under siege here. You know, how many existing mines are losing money here? 50%? Geez, I would guess at least 50% must be losing money here.
And just a final question, Peter Major, with Venetia responsible for around 40% of South Africa's diamond production, as I referenced, the likely consequences for the local economy and mining communities around the operation inevitably will be dire.
They will be, and maybe it's time to say, did politicians have anything to do with this? Not particularly with diamonds. For once, we can't really blame our politicians, but we can blame them for the pain and shrinkage of the rest of the mining industry. And because they had this blatant disregard for any kind of economics, for any kind of understanding and empathy for what the industry was, they had no clue or appreciation how great this industry was from an employment point of view, but how delicate it is and how it needs a government working with them instead of against them. So I repeat, De Beers, they did bear the brunt of the change in mining legislation. Not the brunt, but they bore just as much brunt as the industry. But then they have this tremendous uncontrollable outside pressure, you know, lab-grown diamonds, excess production by other countries on new deposits, a market that maybe the young generation don't appreciate diamonds or want as many. So, yes, now they're going to close that shaft, and they're going into an economy that has been really, really under distressing pressure for the last 2.5 decades. So, yeah, it's coming in. those poor people getting laid off, they don't have other mines to go to. There's already 41% unemployment in this country. That's what makes it devastating instead of just bad.
3,500 people there or thereabouts impacted. Peter Major, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as the immigration debate intensifies, two people have told MoneyWeb at Midday they were stopped by SAPS officers, asked to prove their legal status, and then threatened with detention or deportation. Both allege that bribes were paid. Now, the SAPS tells us it cannot investigate without a case number and only enforces immigration laws set by Home Affairs. We then went to Home Affairs, who told us immigration officers take the lead with police playing a supporting role, but acknowledges that overlapping responsibilities can create opportunities for corruption and abuse. Neither department agreed to join us on air. But I do want to know what the law allows and where a line might be crossed. In that respect, I'm going to talk to James Chapman, who's head of advocacy and a legal advisor at the Scalabrini Centre of Cape Town. It's a non-profit that works to, as it says, welcome, protect, promote and integrate people into local communities. James, I don't know whether you've come across this before. Thank you for joining us. But where exactly does SAPS authority begin and Home Affairs authority take over? I sense it's a bit of a grey area.
Yes, that is correct. So you have cases that fall under the Immigration Act, which is the primary statute, but then you also have cases that fall under the Refugees Act, and I'll talk to that in a moment. Generally speaking, when you look at the arrests for the purposes of identification under Section 41 of the Immigration Act, the Immigration Act allows for a police officer or an immigration officer on reasonable grounds to require a person to identify themselves as either a citizen, permanent resident, or a foreign national, and must satisfy the police officer or immigration officer that they are entitled to be in the Republic.
What would amount to reasonable grounds for stopping someone then?
You see, that is where it becomes sort of problematic and gray area. It may be analogous to your criminal procedure, wherein, you know, there needs to be an indication. It needs to, the reasonable official, the reasonable officer, there must be some sign or indication that somebody is not lawfully present. In practice, though, it's often, it seems to be the rule rather than the exception that most foreign nationals, whether it be in police or combined police and immigration raids, or even when a person approaches a police station, that the default is to require somebody to satisfy the police or immigration official that they're entitled to be in the Republic.
Just very bluntly, can a police officer demand immigration documents without an immigration officer present?
They may, in terms of Section 41, but it is without purpose if they don't incorporate as soon as possible immigration, because the whole basis for identification is that if somebody is found to be not to be entitled to be in the Republic, then the role falls squarely upon immigration then to process somebody in terms of Section 34 of the Immigration Act for the purposes of deportation. And that deportation process, there's a fresh assessment that has to happen from an immigration official as to whether or not the person should be deported, and if they should be deported, whether or not they should be detained pending their deportation. So there's also a possibility of release and processing without detention, but that's solely under immigration. So it doesn't really make sense to stop and ask unless there is something that is unless it's an operation in conjunction with immigration.
An accent or an appearance or nationality, can that be lawful ground for simply stopping and questioning someone?
It can't be. I mean, you how a person appears or their accent in and of itself, it can't be, because everybody is still protected by Section 9 of the Constitution, the right to equality, not to be unfairly discriminated against. You've seen numerous cases where, in terms of xenophobic violence, people are targeted because of how they appear and end up, you know, some are from South African ethnic minorities. There are also a lot of South African nationals who regrettably don't have documentation. So if you base it on how somebody appears or how they speak, you're in a very problematic space. You know, the police still must comply with the Police Act. It's the South African Police Services. It shouldn't be
yeah.
that a person just by how they look or how they sound is immediately demanded of.
So I'm assuming then that the SAPS cannot threaten someone with deportation if Home Affairs has made no formal decision or adjudication.
They have no authority whatsoever. The deportation is solely within the ambit and mandate of the immigration inspector within the Department of Home Affairs.
And if a person, James, is stopped and a demand is made for a bribe from a police officer, what should the person do?
They need to refuse, first and foremost. Secondly, they should lay a complaint. One can raise a complaint with Corruption Watch. One can, because you're dealing with the police, one can lay a complaint with the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. You know, there's also recourse in terms of intimidation, harassment, unlawful arrest, brutality. Any of these cases, you can take both a civil and criminal recourse against them. But yeah, the long story short, it should be to refuse and then also to report.
And just a final question, are you worried against the current backdrop that it's going to be difficult or becoming increasingly difficult to enforce immigration law without enabling profiling, intimidation, as I've suggested, or even what could amount to an abuse of power?
Well, I am worried. I'm also hopeful that we will see more positive conduct, more responsible engagement by politicians. You have the National Action Plan Against Racism and Xenophobia and a real need for the state to work on social cohesion initiatives and for proper capacitation of the police, law enforcement, immigration. That is the route that needs to be taken. But I am obviously apprehensive that it might go the other way, that they might go the route of profiling and the sort of negative tack towards supporting this kind of sort of populist anti-migrant position that unfortunately not only is the your anti-migrant movements, but they're also even maybe officials who are also taking a similar line.
Thank you very much indeed. James Chapman is Head of Advocacy and a Legal Advisor at the Scalabrini Center of Cape Town. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, a proposed offshore deal that would give Israeli-owned Navitas Petroleum a 37.5% stake and operational control of a major West Coast exploration block is facing a degree of scrutiny. The social and environmental justice organization Green Connection says the deal could undermine South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, conflict with its climate commitments, and threaten coastal livelihoods. But here's my question. Should a company's nationality influence a commercial decision? I'm going to talk now to Neville van Rooy, who's Community Outreach Coordinator at the Green Connection. Neville, welcome to you. At its heart, then, is your organization asking government to treat Navitas differently simply because it's Israeli-owned?
Good afternoon to you and good afternoon to the listeners, and thank you for this opportunity. Yeah, we are really looking at the impact that this is going to have on a from an energy perspective on the oil and gas. We are, you know, treating all companies and all activities the same, and we are concerned about the oil and gas activities that is going on in the West Coast, whether it's a Israeli company or a company from elsewhere. We are always calling out on a how the oceans perspective developmental approach, and we believe that we need to move to renewable energy possibilities and or from a company South African perspective or our credibility that is at stake here. We are asking how can we on one end challenge the Israeli situation when it comes to human rights violations, and the next time we are wanting to do business deals with them, how should we deal with such companies? And the government need to take a strong, lawful, transparent and policy position when it comes to Israeli-owned entities.
The ICJ, as we all know, has not ruled that Israel committed genocide. So are you asking the minister to act on allegations that still legally remain untested and undecided?
Yeah, we're actually asking the government to make sure that it communicates the clear foreign policy position or international obligations or when it comes to our constitutional values to South African citizens. That is what we need to know about from a South African perspective, as the people that is impacted, coastal communities that is impacted. And for us, the climate concern groups also, how will we deal with such companies? We're asking that big question, and the governments need to articulate that to us as affected communities or all citizens in South Africa for that matter.
Is your concern more environmental than political?
Yeah, we would say it's positioned somewhere in the middle of that. Both we are articulating our stance where we want to transition to renewable energy quite strongly, and it's a time for us to do that. And fossil fuels need to take a back end because it's got us into this climate crisis position that we are currently in, and therefore we need to move to renewable energy possibilities. And also when it comes to our image as on a global level as well, we were very impressed with what South Africa has did on taking the matter on in human rights violations to the ICJ. And somewhere there needs to be a balanced approach and articulated well to South African citizens.
Would your argument apply to every Israeli-owned business operating in South Africa or only to companies in strategic industries such as oil and drilling?
Israeli companies all blanketed together, but also we are placing the emphasis on the human rights violation element when it's relating to this current situation that we have. But we know that alternatively, South Africa has been having interactions with other organizations on Israeli owned as well. And we're not putting a pressure on those that previously started. But now, specifically because there's a human rights violation element that is at stake here as well, and also our credibility as a South African as well.
Is there evidence that connects Navitas itself to the conduct that South Africa is challenging before the ICJ?
Yeah, we to be honest, are not necessarily sure that it's linked to that, but we have our noises that we are making with all companies related to the fossil fuel ventures from block one all the way to block 11. We are watching that space closely. It's because we are working with coastal communities and working in the oil and gas space and working in the climate action space. And that is why we're making our noises along those levels in particular.
So in effect, the Israeli ownership issue is really just being used to strengthen your argument, which is fundamentally an environmental campaign against offshore drilling.
Yeah, really, we now, since the situation lends itself to that political or geopolitical play field as well, it is not something that we are ignorant about, and we need to speak about it because that is currently on the global political or geopolitical agenda, and that is why we are making both arguments equally strong as well.
What specific and measurable danger then does this exploration block posed to fishing communities at this point? What data supports your argument?
Yeah, we are very much concerned about the ecosystem destructions that is happening, whether it is from a seismic survey, whether it's exploration drilling, whether it's the production phase of the oil and gas coming as well. And we also even can point out the normal or the ongoing fight we have against plastics that is also oil and gas related. And all of that we bundle it under the ocean protection. And when we talk about the oceans, we talk ecosystems, but we also talk about our 50% breathing capacity that the ocean is making available to all people all across the globe. And that is why we emphasize ocean protection is such a crucial thing as well. When it comes also secondary to the coastal communities, we're talking about food sovereignty and food security, and the ocean is playing a crucial part into that food security
and
food sovereignty
as well. There's also an economic dynamic here. How do you answer the argument that offshore gas brings investment, jobs, and greater energy security, which then benefits the community?
Yeah, we also want the energy demand of South Africa to be holistically approached as well. And it can't be that we are dependent on fossil fuels only. There is other possibilities of energy sources that we can harness as a country and as a continent. And this continent is bragging with its renewable energy potential that could be harnessed from a global perspective as well. And we are saying, let's move to that. Why? And the global consensus is that we need to transition away from fossil fuels. And the time for us to do that is now, and not delay the renewable harnessing potential that the continent has. And let us implement it now.
Neville van Rooy, thank you very much indeed. Community Outreach Coordinator at the Green Connection.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, investors may soon be paying as much attention to what companies throw away as they do their financial results. Take a listen to this. Poor waste records, vague recycling claims, and weak audit trails can damage ESG credibility. It can raise compliance risk and even cost businesses contracts. So how reliable is the environmental data that companies are publishing right now? It's a key question. And I'm going to talk to Lawrence Nankisur, who is National Compliance Manager at the waste management company Oracle Environmental Services. Lawrence, a very warm welcome. An important issue, and probably one that many companies either pay lip service to or ignore completely. And do you think organizations may be overstating their environmental performance because the waste data simply cannot be verified?
Yeah, you know, there has been a significant shift over the years, you know, in terms of what the requirements are. And I cannot really say that they're completely ignoring it, but I'll say there's a huge gap in terms of understanding what ESG is all about. And basically, you know, there's a lot of cliche words that are out there about ESG, but when you actually drill down into these things, into the actual data and so forth, you'll notice that there's a big disconnect between what is being shared over the social media platforms mm-hmm. about ESG and what exactly is happening on the ground.
Let me drill down a little bit, Lawrence. What is the most common claim then that companies might make that would fall apart under strict scrutiny?
Well, data accuracy, one of the main important things. You know, obviously, we're talking about ESG, which is a broad word. It's environmental, social, and governance. But we're specifically speaking about environmental here. And when you deal with environmental, you need data accuracy. You need your data to be able to be put under scrutiny, able to be tested, able to be verified, auditable. I mean, just as good as your financial records.
So who inside a business should ultimately be accountable for the accuracy of the data that you're talking about?
Well, you know, they act as various roles and responsibilities, you know, starting from the CEO. But obviously, you know, they appoint many other people into their business to take care of this. So most of the time it rests under the technical managers or the environmental waste managers, or, you know, they have glorified names for all of these people. But usually it's around the environmental manager that takes care of this.
And it's your contention that spreadsheets and certificates from service providers are not enough. Why is that? And what further evidence do you need?
You know, Jeremy, when you look at it, I strongly believe what you cannot measure, you cannot manage. And you have this data that's lying around in all different spreadsheets and, you know, It just makes data analytics very difficult. And for environmental management, you need proper data analytics to be able to track the trends, the volumes, etc., so that you could have a good understanding where your problems lie in the business and where the focus needs to be. And by I guess the reason they do that is because, you know, normally people see waste management as a backdoor thing, and that's where it's kept normally at the back of your company, you know, and they don't really take it seriously until the cost cut starts coming through or when then the compliance orders start coming through.
How difficult is it for a company to prove then, Lawrence, that waste that was supposedly recycled didn't simply end up in a landfill?
Well, there's only one way to prove that, and that's traceability. And therefore, we are making these statements and we're saying that your waste has to be traceable to its disposal site. And there could be like 16 different disposal sites. One of them is the landfill. So whenever the waste leaves the generator through the transporter right to the disposal site, there needs to be an auditable track record so that you can reconcile and say that my waste stream has been dealt with in the proper fashion as required by legislation.
So let me pick you up on traceability then. Do you think waste figures should be independently audited in the same way that financial statements are, for instance?
100%, Jeremy, 100%. I mean, you know, you cannot sit back at a desk and expect to use these volumes and start creating reports and make your company look good. You've got to put on your auditor's cap. You've got to go down the traceability process and verify your data, because sometimes, you know, you could be dealing with service providers or company managers that's always trying to hide data because, you know, it affects their budgets and they do things that are not really compliant, and only to find out that when compliance knocks at your door, all these things are unearthed. So a very important tip is to have your external auditors or independent verification done. And that will keep you safe and keep the company ethically sound.
Do you think investors are genuinely examining the data, Lawrence, or do you think ESG scrutiny still remains largely a box-ticking exercise?
Jeremy, I really believe that 50% are genuine. From my experience with many clients, and that's approximately about 1,600 clients, while the rest, I believe, you know, they want to do the right thing. They are in the right direction. However, because of incompetence in terms of the roles and responsibilities that they employ into the business and the contracts that they issue to companies that actually undertake waste management, etc., this is where the problem lies, and what makes it difficult is that between these two, you can get inaccurate data, inaccurate information, and thus, to me, it sounds like it's not completely, I can't say it's completely, I'd say 50% compliance is there, and 50%, it's just a cliche word.
Just a final one, and this comes to the reality of economics. What does proper traceability cost, and is it realistic for smaller businesses who might think they have other priorities?
No, look, in terms of smaller businesses, and I believe that, you know, South Africa has got quite a good legal system for this. And it's very easy to do. I mean, I'll just give you a simple example. I mean, when we do lift somebody's waste, there's a part that the generator must sign to say that we've lifted certain products at certain hazardous regulation within certain hazardous regulations. Then the transporter will sign to say that he's received it. And then lastly, the disposal site will sign. Now, those three signatures on the legal waste manifest document constitute that the waste was disposed in accordance with regulation and it was safe. So it's very easy for small businesses to do this. It's very easy. And so I cannot say it's very costly. For small businesses to do this, you don't need to get an external consultant. You just have to be diligent about who you give the business to and just take a day off in the month or whatever, do the traceabilities, and that'll be fine. But where you've got big businesses and multiple streams, etc., you'd need more auditors that are competent, because obviously, Jeremy, there's many different waste types and waste products, and obviously you have to have some type of knowledge there on that issue.
Lawrence Nankisur is National Compliance Manager at the waste management company Oracle. Thank you very much indeed. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.